Welcome to Philosophy and Faith, where our goal is to help you navigate your intellectual and spiritual journey, especially in regards to topics like God, faith and doubt, meaning and purpose, and more. I'm Nathan Beasley.
And I'm Daniel Jepson. And together we discuss the big questions that humans have wrestled with for thousands of years.
We're glad you can join us. Well, today we are excited to begin a new series on the history of philosophy.
Yeah, we sure are.
There's a long history here.
Yeah, about 3,000 years almost. There's a lot to cover.
Yeah, this will be good, and it'll be over a number of episodes. We'll see how recording goes and maybe split some of these into 2 weeks and that kind of thing. But there's a lot here. Just reading your notes from today, it's going to be a good conversation, but it will be full as well. So
it will. Now, we're going to talk about the history of philosophy. We're not going to talk about every aspect of every philosopher. We're going to focus on the main currents of thought, how they've influenced others, and in particular, how they've influenced our modern culture today. Those are the streams of thought we're going to focus on and try to tell a consistent narrative story of the history of Western thought as best we can.
Sweet, sweet. So this is kind of more Western thought. What do you mean by Western thought?
So Western thought would be the philosophy basically of Greek and Rome originally, and then of Arab philosophers, Jewish philosophers, and European and then American and Australian philosophers.
Okay, okay. So not so much in Asia or African or South American.
Right. Okay.
Well, cool. I think the first question I have is, why a history of philosophy?
I saw a movie the other night, and I don't remember if they were quoting someone else or not, but there was a quote from that movie that really resonated with me on this point. And it was something like, "We study history not to remember the past, but to understand the present." And that's it. This isn't just an academic exercise. The ideas that we have today don't come out of thin air. They are the result of all this stream of Western thought and idea in the areas of philosophy and religion primarily. Everything else comes much later and is, to a certain degree, dependent upon those things.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's very grounded in the present and for the present.
Exactly. Let me give you an example. We were talking to a woman not too long ago. She was a Christian, and she said, "You know, I don't have the normal Christian ideas, though, about the afterlife." And when we explored that a bit, she said, "Well, I don't believe we just go off to heaven and don't have a body. I think we have a body here on this earth. So I'm a little different in that." Yeah, and I was thinking, I'm like, well, that's the plain teaching of the Bible, is that we will have a resurrection body, that we will be here upon the earth, not some disembodied state out in a different dimension or something. And yet, the reason that resonated with me is because I know that for most people who have grown up in a certain context, that is the idea that they have, that the body is just going to be cast away. We're going to live, our spirits are going to live this disembodied state in union with God forever in heaven. That is not a biblical idea. That is an idea that is primarily influenced by Greek thought and philosophy.
Yeah, so the point that all that stuff affects us and how we think about scripture and how we think about all these things is, even though it goes back thousands of years, it's still very much present and alive today.
Yes. I just thought of this, so maybe it doesn't make sense or not. But sometimes I do some counseling. One of the things I've learned is that early childhood wounds that people have, so not physical wounds, but wounds that they have in their spirit, they don't become less important. They don't become minimized as you get older simply because time has passed. Rather, the earlier those wounds are and the ideas about themselves that people form because of that, the more foundational they are to that person's thought. So it's actually the oldest ideas that are the most important is where I'm trying to get at.
Oh, yeah. That's a good illustration. So just getting into this, and we've defined this in the past, but for today's episode, can you define philosophy for us once more?
Yeah, and we did talk about this, I think, the very first episode. Now, the term just means the love of wisdom, and there is no fixed definition that all philosophers would agree on, so It's not like history or archaeology or physics, where there are pretty clear lines of demarcation between the disciplines. The line between philosophy and theology or religion or even science originally is pretty fuzzy. There's a lot of overlap. But that idea basically carries the thought that what we're talking about is understanding the ultimate questions of human life and of reality itself. Now, usually when you talk about a history of philosophy, you have to ask the question, all right, well, who counts as a philosopher, right? Who are we going to include, or what kinds of thought are we going to include? And in particular, one of the more live questions is, okay, do we count, for example, St. Anselm, or do we count Thomas Aquinas, or are they theologians and not philosophers, even though, let's say, Thomas Aquinas was one of the most influential philosophers or figures in the history of philosophy.
Shows what you believe about his title there.
Yes, it does. I'm showing my hand here. Usually there are two options. Like when people try to define who's a philosopher and who's not, or what's a philosophy and what's not, you can define it by subject matter and concerns, so the things it's dealing with, those ultimate questions, or by methodology. By methodology, what we mean is that some say that you must rule out any arguments or ideas or authority apart from autonomous human reasoning. So what's only going to count are people who do not have any religious presuppositional commitments. Now, that seems flawed to me, because it's actually making an a priori commitment, a commitment before you even begin this discussion. It's deciding a philosophical question, whether human reasoning is the only legitimate epistemological tool, before you actually begin to even think about philosophy. So it's making a philosophic choice up front before you even talk about philosophy or begin studying it. So that's why I tend to go with the latter route, just because of that particular reason, and because I think it'd be silly to exclude people like Thomas Aquinas, even though he had a specific religious commitment.
So you're saying that he's a philosopher because he was thinking deeply about these biggest questions of life?
Yes, and reasoning about those.
Okay, so question about who's a philosopher, is it as broad as anybody who reasons about the biggest? I mean, is it fair to say I've heard it said everybody's a philosopher, just not everybody's a good one?
Well, that's true in some degree. But when we're talking more specific about the history of philosophy, we're talking about people who wrote down their ideas and had influence on others.
Okay, so where do you even begin with the history of philosophy then?
You know, that's a question I wrestled with and probably overthought quite a bit. I want to go as far back as the written record will allow us to go.
Whoa, how far does that go?
I would say it goes back to the Minoan civilization, which is going to be dated between 3000 and 1100 BC. So right in the middle of that, around 2000 BC to 1500 BC, we have philosophical ideas being brought forth that we can talk about. Now, the first actual philosopher usually is regarded as Thales,
okay,
about 625 BC. So that's T-H-A-L-E-S.
Okay.
Thales of Miletus.
And so he's kind of the first person who is reflecting on the biggest questions of life that even began a millennia before him.
He is the first person that we know of that was teaching things in a systematic and rational way.
Oh, okay.
Probably there were quite a few different kinds of people doing that beforehand, but we don't have record of that. Okay. And even what we have of Thales comes much later and it's incomplete. So we're kind of reading between the lines, as it were. But I want to talk about, especially in this first episode or two, what happens before him. Because people were obviously thinking about ultimate reality before Thales. And we have to remember, Thales and the other earliest Greek philosophers don't arrive on the scene from nowhere. They arrive from the intellectual currents that are around them. And they're going to breathe those things in, like the air. And they're going to do that, for the most part, subconsciously, like we all do. So there are certain ideas, thoughts, themes that are already in the air in the culture that they're going to build upon. Thales' thought is not creation ex nihilo, you know, out of nothing. It's taking pre-existing thoughts and giving his own interpretation upon them. So I want to, at least today, maybe next episode as well, talk about those pre-existing thoughts that were really the seedbed, the foundation of all the early Greek philosophy, and really that influence is still today.
So what was some of the air that he was breathing, the philosophical current, so to speak, that he was writing down?
All right.
And where did he even get it?
To avoid an infinite digression, I think we'd have to probably start at Crete, probably 1,000 years before Thales, so 1,500 to 2,000 years BC. I think we can understand a little bit about what the people were thinking about. One place to start talking about this is the idea of myth. Myth is the universal seedbed of thought for humanity. Every culture we have ever encountered has thought in terms of myth, at least originally. But we have to understand, when we're talking about Greek myth, we usually get Greek myth wrong. We usually think wrongly about it.
How so? What do you mean?
We tend to think of Greek mythology as centered on these Olympian gods. So you have Zeus, you have Hera, you have Apollo and the others, and they reside on Mount Olympus. And that is certainly, obviously, within Greek thought. It's memorialized so well and beautifully in Homer, which is why we have it so predominantly in our mind. But there is an earlier stream of mythology that's in common with that and was actually more influential in the ancient world and still has influence today.
So what is the stream, or what are the streams?
I call this the 3M theme within the ancient Greek world. You could also call it the shapeless stream. The shapeless stream. That's going to be the main idea, main metaphor here. But I call it 3M because it's Minoan, it's mystery, and it's mysticism.
Okay, we're going to have to unpack each of those terms there.
Yeah, I thought we probably would.
What is Minoan? I've never even heard of this.
Okay, so picture the Mediterranean Sea, right?
Okay.
All right, so it's kind of like this oval or like an egg on its side. And then right at the very top of that, from our perspective, usually when we look on a map, you have Greece, like a hand reaching down with its fingers into the heart of the Mediterranean. And then right near where those fingers reach down, there's a very large island called Crete.
Okay, yeah.
You've probably seen that on a map.
Yeah, sure.
I flew over it once. It's pretty cool.
Did you meet some Minoans?
No, I flew over it. But there in Crete was the first European city, Knossos. And that is the heart of what's called the Minoan civilization. Now, Crete's position right there meant that it was strategically located at the crossroads of a lot of different trading routes, but also the civilization those trading routes were attached to, with their own ideas and their own cultures and their own myths.
Oh.
Yeah. Really, I think probably if you understand what happens here, you're understanding what's happening in a large part of the civilized world, at least the part of it that's west of India or China, at least.
Okay. So it's the crossroads of the Mediterranean, so to speak.
It was then.
Okay.
It was then. Because remember, Knossos is going to predate almost any city on the Greek mainland. It's called the first city of Europe.
Okay. And what time period are we talking about here?
There seems to be some sort of settlements as early as 3000 BC, but most people date Minoan civilization from about 2000 BC.
So this is way before Socrates and Plato and Homer.
Centuries before.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is part of their culture and heritage, because these ideas, they don't get discarded. They just get buried in the subconscious of a culture, basically. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that these particular ideas that we'll be talking about don't actually get buried as much as they continue to flow all the way until the end of Hellenic culture. And in fact, if you look at Greek culture as a whole, for the most part, the mythology of Minoa, the mythology of Minoan culture is going to be more influential than the Olympian mythology and the Greek philosophy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious to unpack that. Are we ready to unpack some of the influence there?
Sure. So just by way of explanation, by the way, they didn't call themselves the Minoans. We don't know what they call themselves because we're reading between the lines. We don't have a lot of materials. We're understanding a lot of this through archaeology rather than through literature. But there seems to be a pretty good consensus on what the archaeology tells us. Arthur Evans was a British archaeologist, and about a century ago, a little bit more, he excavated this city of Knossos on the island of Crete. He saw all these intricate underground rooms like a labyrinth. And to him, it recalled the myth of King Minos and the Minotaur, and the Minotaurs living in the labyrinth. He had rule over the Greek mainland, and they had to, in the Aegean, and they had to send these young men and young women to be sacrifices to the Minotaur, who was this half bull, half human monster that lived in this labyrinth that no one could figure out the way. He named it Minoa because of that, but we don't actually know what it's called.
Okay.
But we do know some things about their religion and their thought. We know that they spread their wares and their knowledge around the Mediterranean. Maybe I'll break this down into two parts, but they're going to be very much related, okay? So Minoan religion and then Minoan philosophy. So one of the things you see is that the people of that time, as part of their religious rites, were led into a cave or a part of the underworld. So they're going down into the earth, all right?
Okay.
And then as they go down into the earth, as part of some ritual, they are given intoxicants or drugs that would cause hallucinations. So it's not exactly clear what this is, if it's some sort of something like magic mushrooms or if it was something a little bit different. But they had some sort of altered state experience. Sometimes this would be seen as something like, you know, you're actually dying and you're in this cave, you're buried, you're in Mother Earth, as it were. And then you have this altered state experience, something akin to dying, and then you come out of that and you have your life after that. There seems to be implicit in this, what's really important is that this altered state is about union with the divine, not a personal divine, but with the stream of being, the shapeless stream that runs through all things. That's a segue then into Minoan philosophy. We'll talk about that stream.
Yeah, so already you can see the theme of death and resurrection, union with God. That's crazy to see those themes all the way back then. It's not like these are new ideas of death and resurrection and union with God.
Right, exactly.
So that was kind of their practice. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
The way that you would unite with God is going to be quite a bit different than, say, Christian thought. But yeah.
Yeah, you gotta get super high and
yes,
interesting. So that the religious practice,
right? But again, there's no clear separation between religion and philosophy in any part of the ancient world. I think we can kind of separate some of those out, and I've tried to do that here.
So the religious would be like the definition that would maybe be like more practice, but the philosophy would be kind of like the ideas that go behind or underneath the practice. Is that how you're defining it?
Yeah, that's kind of the distinction I'm making.
Okay.
But again, that's not a distinction you would make in the ancient world.
Okay.
So the shapeless stream, this is the idea that there is this stream or current of reality or life or energy that flows endlessly in a cycle. So think of a literal stream, but it doesn't have any banks or borders. So it doesn't have any depth. It just flows. And then think of that kind of like the precipitation cycle. You know, the water flows into the ocean, and then the ocean evaporates the water into the clouds. The clouds rain down and create the stream again. So time is cyclical.
Okay.
That's an idea that you'll later find in some of the Greek philosophers, but especially in Eastern thought.
Yeah, it's given me some flashbacks to some of our earlier conversations.
Yes. And to me, at least, it's unclear which influenced the other, but it's there.
Oh, that's super interesting, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So you had this endless shapeless stream of life or being, and then individual things, people, plants, animals, they're almost like a certain part of that shapeless stream of being takes physical form for a while, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, you know, depending on what plant or animal it is, maybe 80 years if it's a human. And then when it dies, it goes back into that endless, shapeless stream. That is the heart of this. Now, that idea, think through that. Everything ultimately is one. It's a shapeless stream. It's not a person. It's a force. It's a thing. So that's the ultimate reality. And it's guided by another impersonal force you would call fate, something like that. So there's no person guiding this to create certain forms by purpose or by will. It just happens irrationally. So you've got this shapeless stream. Now, what happens then? Well, your goal is when you have those experiences is to somehow reenact that union that you had with that shapeless stream, and then also perceive what is to come, that you will go back into that. So there is an idea inherent here. There is a rational idea, but you understand that not by argument or even by a tradition, but more by union, this mystical union that's brought about by these hallucinogenic experiences and substances. So that's the heart of this. And then this seems to be mixed in together with this idea that there is a mother goddess, Mother Earth, Earth itself as the symbol and the ultimate physical expression of this shapeless stream of being. You go down to the earth because that's where you came from, that's where you're going to go. You have this dual image of birth and nourishment, but then also death. The earth gives life to things, but then it takes it back. Sometimes you would have then a figure of a mother goddess, and often you would have lesser daemons. So that is a word for some sort of lesser god.
So not demon?
They're related, but they're different words. This is D-A-E-M-O-N, okay. Daemon. Okay. Yeah, they're related, but they're different words actually.
So it's trying to understand the concepts of like good and bad, right and wrong. That is that kind of how they're making sense of this, or not really?
Actually, no. Ethical component is almost entirely absent in this.
Oh, okay.
So the daemons are not good or bad. They're just other nature gods who are consorts of Mother Earth too, but they're much lesser status than she is.
Okay. Is Mother Earth a good person or figure or what, however, being, or not really moral status attributed to her?
Not that I've ever seen. She just is. And it's unclear whether you believe that that is a person or you're creating this figure to represent the irrational forces that don't have a personality.
Okay.
I think probably more the latter.
Some kind of anthropomorphism
thing
going on. Okay. So the moral and ethic piece is absent. That's super interesting to think about. A culture where part of their myth is not related to morals. I wonder if there's other things that aren't present that get built upon later.
Yeah, there is. Let's explore that one part though. One of the things that amazed me when I started studying more ancient religions and philosophies was that morality wasn't really much of an issue for most ancient religions.
That seems really surprising.
Yeah, because for us, it's at the heart of it, right? But if you went through the rituals back then, you did so for religious reasons. But for the most part, these gods are not interested in telling you how to be moral people or what you should actually do. They're more interested in you doing the certain rites or experiences.
Maybe this is more a sociological question than a philosophical question, but did they not have rules and laws and that kind of thing as well? Or just maybe that stuff wasn't grounded in the divine?
It wasn't necessarily grounded in the divine.
Okay.
There would be rules, of course, but these were rules primarily that were designed to help the city state. So there are more laws than inward ethical duties.
Okay.
So as long as you followed the laws and you did the rites, you were good. There wasn't this inward heart morality or ethics that become the central part of the monotheistic religions, at least.
So it wasn't an emphasis on character development,
no,
for example. Okay.
No. Notice also, you said, what else is not present in this? Well, it's not really something that you rationally discover and argue about. It's more based upon experience. So if you're going to talk about epistemology, how you know things, this is not a rationalistic type of philosophy. This is an experiential type. It's irrational. It's more mystical. We'll talk about that. It's also monistic.
Monistic. Okay. What do you mean by that?
So monism is the idea that everything is one.
Like the Eastern thought kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Eastern thought is usually monistic. Okay. So monism says that everything ultimately boils down to one thing, and then other individual things you have to explain in some way. And that becomes the real challenge when you have a monistic system of thought. But this is monistic because there's one primary thing, and that's this shapeless stream, and things come and go out of that, but they don't ever have their own separate status that's eternal. They just exist for a little while in some physical form, and then they go back into that. And that idea of a monism that underlies reality, you're going to see that again and again and again in Greek thought. And not just Greek thought. It is a perpetual, I'm not going to say temptation because that's a loaded word. It's a perpetual idea that many people go back to, that all is one. And then the big question is going to be, and the big problem for Greek philosophy, all the way through Plato at least, is between the one and the many. How do you explain for the oneness of everything, but also individual things? So that idea of the one and the many goes back centuries, maybe even a millennium, before Plato gave what many people regard as kind of the definitive answer to that from a Greek point of view.
Wow. Okay, I want to bring us back for a second, because you're talking about the maybe three different influences, the three M's, or the shapeless stream that we were talking about a minute ago. You said Minoan, and we just kind of have unpacked that a little bit, coming from Crete, and some of the philosophy and maybe religious practices coming from there. But you mentioned these other two M's, which were mystery and mysticism. And so I'm wondering if we can go ahead and talk about mystery religions.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by mystery, is what you would call mystery religions, or what they were at least called that later. I'm not sure when they started getting that designation, but it's apt because they are dealing with the mysteries of this world and how to understand them. They're also called nature religions sometimes because they have a lot of similarities with nature religions. You're going to see that these actually start with the Minoans. I mean, their thought is obviously based upon this, but these mystery religions are going to extend for centuries in their influence. And when you read the New Testament, the epistles are written to people who are dealing with initiates of the mystery religion all around them. So, for example, if Paul's writing to the church in Ephesus in, 70 AD, something like that. That idea of a mystery religion or mystery religions, it's going to be very prevalent. I would guess, I can't prove this, and I don't know if anyone has tried to, I would guess more people than not in a city like Ephesus or Corinth who were not Christians or Jews were probably initiates of one of the mystery religions.
Okay. One of those maybe being related to Artemis?
Yeah, that's one of them. I mean, they're all kinds, but they had some similarities and they had differences.
Okay. These mystery religions maybe started loosely based on what was happening in Crete, but maybe they got taken or transported because it was a crossroads of the Mediterranean kind of area. And then they kind of go to these different locations and they just kind of begin to develop like that and get intermixed with other myths going on with those pockets around the Mediterranean. Is that kind of how it's
happening? Yeah, especially the North Mediterranean.
Okay.
I don't know if there were much in the way of mystery religions in, say, North Africa or Palestine. I can't answer that. But from my own limited knowledge, I'm thinking especially in the north half, as it were, of the Mediterranean basin.
So it's the spinoffs influenced by what the Minoans, perhaps influenced by maybe other things, but they begin to take root. And there's some patterns.
Yes.
That historians and philosophers can kind of point to that have shown their influence.
Yes. And then they will join together, syncretize with some of the Olympian religion deities later on. And then they're going to morph into a more full system of Gnosticism a little bit in the century or two after Christ.
So this is still pre-Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, but it's pre-Mount Olympus as well?
Yes. But it's also contemporary with them and going past them in history.
Contemporary with them, just forming in different location, in different geographic locations.
Well, they're going to be mixed together, even in the same city.
Okay. I know this is why earlier it was difficult to point to like the specifics of polytheistic religions or philosophies, because they're so diverse.
Right.
But there's going to be some, you said, syncretism going on and all that.
Yeah. Think of it as a river delta. So you have one main stream or one main flow, but then it begins diverging into all these different channels, and then some of the channels join together with other channels, and then maybe they diverge again. That's kind of what's going on here with these mystery religions and Greek thought in general.
Okay. Yeah, that muddies the water quite a bit. But what are some of the kinds, or what would maybe be some of the families of those mystery religions, or that kind of thing?
Let's explore one of these mystery religions. because I think it's probably the most influential. And that is the Eleusinian religions and cults based upon the city of Eleusia, which is near Athens.
Is that like the brewing company from Seattle?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know that brewing company.
Okay.
So there is a suburb of Athens. Maybe that's probably not the right word. There was a city nearby Athens called Eleusia or Eleusia. And it's estimated that for a good part of this time frame we're talking about, the majority of Athenian citizens were actually initiates of this Eleusinian mystery religion. So put that in your mind. This is the same Athens where you've got these Greek philosophers doing their thing, but at the same time, a majority of the people are going to be initiates of this mystery religion, this one particular branch. That's pretty mind-blowing. And when I understood that, or when I read that, like, wow, I had no idea.
Wow.
All right, so what happens? This is a really good example of the mystery religions, but also the way that religion and philosophy work together, and also how divorced it was from ethics, like we were just talking about. So once a year, there would be a yearly festival at Eleusia. People would go, and you would go to become an initiate. So you would go once in your lifetime, kind of like a pilgrimage to Mecca or something. And after that, you were considered an initiate. You were part of the group. And during this time, when you went to this festival, you would be led down into an underworld or a cave. Sound familiar?
It does, yeah.
Yeah. And you would be given some sort of intoxicant.
Oh, okay. Again with the mushrooms.
Yeah, again with the mushrooms or something that would cause hallucinations or an altered state of consciousness.
Okay.
And that part's pretty clear. So there's some sort of altered state. It's often described as death-like. The old person that you were dies, and now as an initiate that's gone through this, you are a new person.
Like a new birth or rebirth.
Yeah. I'm not sure they use that term or not. But,
right.
But they would consider themselves changed people. And then you would go back to your normal way of life. So there's no moral, there's no ethical part of this. There's this some sort of mystical union brought about through substances that produces some sort of altered state that has spiritual significance for you. Some sort of union, I think, would be the right way to think about that.
Okay, so we've talked about Minoan culture as one of the M's. We've talked about the mystery religions as one of the M's. And then the third one is mysticism. So what's mysticism? What's the link between the other two here?
Yeah, it's kind of the common thread that runs between these two, and it's something that we still have with us in many ways, for good and for bad. It's a human trait. It's not necessarily a philosophical idea, so it can be used for good or for bad. I define mysticism as basically trying to experience God through immediate and non-rational means. Immediate, what I mean is it's not mediated. It doesn't come through righteousness, holy living, learning the scriptures or other things, or through things like sacraments. So it doesn't come through those. It's something that you receive more directly. That's what I mean.
I see. So using kind of the technical.
Yes.
Yeah.
So not right away, but not through.
Not mediated.
Right.
Something else.
Exactly. And then it's non-rational. So you're looking at an experience, not a teaching, not a doctrine. You're looking at a union with the divine as you understand that. That's at the heart of mysticism.
One of the questions here is, did people pick these religions? Did they decide between these? Or is it just something that they're born into and they just embraced it because it was part of their cultural and tribal heritage?
I would guess it'd be part of both.
Yeah.
So certainly when you come to the later stages of Greek culture or early Roman culture, you would, if you were in a large enough city, have a choice of which mystery religions you wanted to become an initiate of. But for most people, especially earlier centuries, there's going to be one predominant way of thought, right? And almost everyone's going to cling to that.
Okay. You're not saying that it's irrational, but you're just saying it's non-rational. There's not this emphasis that we have now post-Enlightenment on rationality.
Yeah. And irrational, I'm using it in a more technical term, so not in a pejorative term. For example, I believe that we choose to believe what we believe about God or ultimate things for both rational and non-rational reasons. So rational would be logic, thinking through, reasoning, looking at the evidence and then reasoning based upon that. Irrational would be choice, things I choose to value my own experiences. Those are things you don't put into an argument, and you can't put into an argument. Now, irrational sometimes can mean crazy and anti-rational, and that's not what I'm trying to convey here.
You're just saying that there's an emphasis in this on your experience of union with the divine, not weighing the evidence.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Yeah. Again, a large part of this, you're seeking experience. You are not seeking knowledge, at least not intellectual knowledge. And this experience bypasses the mind, but it also bypasses the body. So this isn't something that you do, for example, like you would take in a sacrament or that you would work to serve other people. This is an experience of your inner being that your body doesn't really participate in, which is ironic because it comes through physical substances.
The hallucinogenics.
Right. But the point is that what the inner part of you, the non-bodily part, that is some sort of a temporary manifestation of this shapeless stream, is now communing with that shapeless stream in some way. So that's what I'm trying to get across there. And in this, we see kind of the first idea of humans being made of different parts, body and mind, and then spirit or soul. This idea that we have separate parts, this is not Hebrew thought. This is not Bible thought. This is Greek thought and the earliest kinds of Greek thought.
Oh, man, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it conflict with biblical thought? Or maybe it's, I don't know. Yeah.
That's a great question. I think it can. I think the Bible will use these terms, obviously.
Yeah.
But you can use a term in two different ways. You can use a term like soul in two different ways. You can use it as it's this thing that's separate from your body that existed before your body and will exist after, or you can view it as one aspect of your body, like your strength or your loving or your thoughts, things that, yeah, you can talk about them conceptually and make them distinct in your mind in that way, but they're all enmeshed so closely with who you are that you can't separate those things and have them as a separate entity apart from you.
Yeah, it seems that Paul seemed to talk about Christianity being a very embodied thing, and what happens in the body affects what's in the spirit and vice versa.
Yes.
So not like they're distinct and separate in that one doesn't affect the other. So.
Right. Yeah, and I think the Bible Project put this very well. We are not people who have a soul. We are a soul. And we are a soul that's by necessity and flesh within a body. Mm-hmm. So at the heart, that's who we are.
So going back all the way to the beginning, to have a conceptualization of heaven that's disembodied, you are, in a sense, your body.
Yes.
Like, your all your personality, all your emotions, all your intellect, all your rationality is embodied in you. And it doesn't really make sense to have a disembodied spirit that is you floating somewhere in the ether because it wouldn't be you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's just super interesting.
Yeah.
And a different way of thinking, because I feel like when seeing this, I think some of my own thinking is influenced. Oh, yeah, I think of mind, body, and soul like being distinct entities sometimes like that. Just
sure.
But maybe I've just assumed that and it's just come from historical heritage or philosophical
exactly.
heritage.
Yeah. It's part of the air that we breathe.
Yeah.
Even people who are not religious at all make a distinction between body, soul, spirit as if their body and their soul are separate things, you know. So it's not just people who come from a religious tradition that view. This is part of our ongoing thought in the Western world, that our body and soul and spirit, or sometimes people just say body and soul, are these things that can be divided.
Yeah, and death divides them. Like your body dies, but your spirit lives forever.
Right. Now, when you come to Christianity in the New Testament, you see that there is a sense in which the death of our physical body here does not mean that we are extinguished. It means that God's power is then able to recreate that body and soul in a different way. So we will still have an embodied existence. Our body will be different in a way that we can't understand right now. But the point of what Paul is teaching, for example, in 1 Corinthians 15, it's very clear. The goal is not a disembodied existence. That may not even be possible. Maybe it is. Maybe God can do that. But the goal is that we are reformed body and soul into a new being, that we have a physical existence upon the earth.
My mind's going crazy right now. Because we talk what happens after you die, and if the biblical conception is that, okay, we're embodied souls, then maybe that's not really a good question, because maybe there isn't any, maybe there's no conscious waiting before the resurrection. Maybe just the consciousness resumes with the resurrection. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this kind of all for the first time.
Sure. Yeah, and maybe that's the case from our experience, at least, that when we, and this is getting off topic a little bit,
but yeah.
that when we die, from our experience, because we cease consciousness, but we are restored to consciousness through Christ resurrecting us, or God resurrecting us with Christ, rather, that when that happens, in our experience, one follows immediately after the other, even though from an outside observer, there may be a gap of time between those two things.
Wow, I could talk about this all day.
Yeah.
let me bring us back here. So we talked about the three M's. We talked about how there have been some themes about death and going into the ground and hallucinogenics, and then union with the one, and kind of this monism kind of thought, and it all begins in Crete and then kind of moves out and then mixes with cultures and all this stuff. One of the questions I have is related to the Olympian gods.
Okay. Yeah.
So when did these guys come in? What's their influence? Because we talked about them showing up simultaneously, or at least in the same time as some of these mystery religions around the north part of the Mediterranean. So walk us through the Olympian gods and how that was all formulated.
Okay. Well, it goes beyond my expertise, certainly. From what I understand, though, Homer and Hesiod are the ones that we look to when we think about the Olympian gods. And Homer, of course, is more familiar to us, the Iliad and the Odyssey. But he's placing all this activity 500 years before when he's writing. So he's writing something like the 8th century BC. We don't know the exact dates on Homer. So he's writing them, and at that time then, he's got to have that background of people who already know about these gods to some degree. So probably, at least by 800 or 900 BC, you have the worship of the Olympian gods, or at least people familiar with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Unless he's just making it up. Is there any possibility that he's just writing a story?
I think archaeology, you have other evidence of people recognizing and worshiping the gods before Homer would be dated. But what's interesting, though, is that later on, say by about 400 BC, 300 BC, the Olympian gods are not really that honored anymore. They're not looked up to. You have a revival of the same themes and sometimes the same activities with the earlier stream, the shapeless stream that we were talking about. In that sense, we tend to view the Olympian gods as defining all of Greek ancient history and the worldview, but it was more, not a blip on the radar screen, it was much more than that, but it certainly wasn't the dominant way people thought about mythology in ancient Greece, if you look at the whole history.
That's totally different than I would have imagined.
Yeah. And there seems to be a parallel between people beginning to develop city-states and then worshipping the Olympian gods instead of the previous, more irrational gods or divine, or however you want to call it. So there seemed to be then an understanding we need order, we need harmony, and that's what the Olympian gods did. They emphasized order and harmony. They emphasized masculine traits as they understood them. Apollo was kind of the archetype. You know, he was a warrior, but he was also this very rational being of perfect proportions and harmony. So you had this upward orientation. So remember in the previous mythology, you had a downward orientation. You went into the earth. There was Mother Earth. Now you have Zeus as the ultimate one on top of this highest mountain in Greece.
Huh.
And you had people viewing the gods as basically inhabiting the sky region. That's where their activities are kind of at. So they reside there on Mount Olympus. But really, I think there's more of an emphasis that these people are dwelling in the sky, as it were. So it's an upward orientation instead of a downward. It's masculine instead of the feminine. It's ordered in harmony instead of the irrational and mystical union. And so there's quite a bit of difference between these. And all this is going to be mixed together then in Greek culture. I should emphasize, though, that though the Greek gods may individually symbolize some sort of rationality, if you looked at the ultimate reality of even the Olympian religion, I think you'd have to say that it's irrational. Again, not anti-rational. But what determines everything? It's fate. It's blind fate. Even the gods are subject to it. Even the gods cannot change fate. And fate is not there for a purpose. There's no one directing fate towards a reason, towards a purpose, towards a goal. It simply is. In that sense, it is fundamentally non-rational. So Greek religion seems then to me to be a way to try to impose order, harmony, and these other things, while at the same time, at the heart of it, fate is kind of the same thing as that shapeless stream. It's maybe a more philosophical way to put it. You've got this irrational, non-purposeful, because it's a non-personal force that directs everything. And that's at the heart of reality. And that's where Greek philosophy is going to begin. One other thing here about ethics in Olympian religion, you're not going to get ethics from the gods.
Yeah, they had their own ethical issues.
Yes.
If we can impose that kind of anachronistically.
Zeus was a greater sinner, if we can use that term, than the average Greek would have been, I would guess. But the big emphasis here is on a type of moderation, avoiding hubris, exceeding your place, therefore. So hubris isn't quite the same as pride, but it has the idea of wanting too much and going beyond, transgressing the barriers of what it means to be a human. And then either the gods or more fully fate will punish you to restore the balance, as it were.
Is fate kind of like karma?
It's similar, but it's not quite the same. They're both impersonal forces that control all things, but I think the mechanism,
okay,
probably,
yeah,
say.
I mean, karma is probably a little bit more of a technical term than...
And it's more developed.
And more developed than, as I'm thinking about it, when I just see memes about instant karma and that kind of thing. So
yeah.
Okay. So we've been talking a lot. There's been a lot here. I'm just wondering if you can summarize, and then we'll talk a little bit about where we're going over the next few episodes.
Main thing is that we study the history, especially the history of philosophy and ideas, not to remember the past, but to understand the present. These ideas, we don't outgrow. We don't put them behind us. They're simply buried in the subconsciousness of humanity, or at least Western humanity. And these ideas of this non-rational life force that just is here, that all things are related to, but it's not directed. These ideas of valuing the mind or the soul above the body, and having two spheres, as it were, of body and soul within a human, and valuing soul over body. These things influence us still today, and they're going to influence greatly Thales and the other philosophers we're going to talk about. They're going to influence Plato. And Plato is the one who, probably more than any other person, influenced Western thought, other than the scriptures themselves. I think if you want to understand Western thought, you're looking primarily at two streams. One is Greek philosophy, especially Plato, Aristotle, what comes out of that. And then the other is biblical thought. And how those two things mesh together is the history of Western thinking.
Wow. Okay. That's great. Thank you. So where are we going? Where are we going from here? What's the next episode?
All right. With that background, we're going to be talking about the earliest attempts of human reason to understand the world, not based on the traditions they had received, but through using the human mind itself. Now, we have to understand, they're, in a sense, are going to be dependent on the things we've just talked about here. But the big step that they're going to make then is that they're going to try to understand what reality consists of using their human reasoning alone. Now, whether they understood how much their reasoning was shaped by the culture they were in or not, obviously that's unclear to us, and maybe it's going to vary by person. But out of that seedbed, you have people who are going to arise, and they're going to say, okay, what can we know about what's ultimately real? So the first group of philosophers are really going to be focused on the physical questions of what is the ultimate reality? What is that shapeless stream? Can we give it a name? What does it consist of? And how do other things come and go out of that? So they're going to be focused on that idea. And that contrast then between the one and how to explain the many based upon the one is going to be really at the heart of where we're going or where Greek thought goes in the next several centuries.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I think it'll be really good. Already, this has been a great conversation and packed full of a lot of good information. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. See you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, click follow or subscribe depending on your platform. Check the notification bell so you're up to date with new episodes and leave us a review. Until next time.